International Reports, around the world with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation.
Hello and welcome to another edition of International Reports. I'm Eric Olander. The Sahel region in Africa has been in the news quite a bit over the past year. You may have heard about a series of coups there where the military deposed deeply entrenched political leaders in places like Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. You may have also heard about how France's long-standing presence in these regions, ties rooted in the imperial era, were upended when most of the countries in the Sahel expelled the French. Those stories all got quite a bit of attention, especially in the European media. But today we're going to take you to a part of the Sahel that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it really should. If you look at a map of Africa and go right to the center, towards the bottom of the Sahara Desert, you'll find Lake Chad. This is an absolutely fascinating region as it sits at the intersection of four Sahelian countries: Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. It's also right there on the front lines of climate change and a major hub for Islamic militants who are creating very difficult challenges for many of the 17 million residents who live around the Lake Chad area. Ulf Lessing, who is the head of regional programs in the Sahel for the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, recently traveled to Lake Chad to cover the story for International Reports, and we are thrilled to have him on the line today from his office in Bamako, Mali, to talk about his latest story, Why Lake Chad Offers Ideal Conditions for Islamic Terrorists. Ulf, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Before we get into the security and geopolitics related to Lake Chad, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the lake and the region, and that this is a region that has to support millions of people. Long time ago, it was the world's sixth largest lake decades ago, and it sustained 20 million people through farming, fishing, and trade. But you point out in your report, that's no longer the case. Why?
Yeah, I mean, the lake has definitely changed. It used to be really huge. If you look at a map or a satellite picture that looks at this huge lake, now it's more like a puddle or like a shallow pool. I mean, it lost a lot of, you know, water in the past 40 years. Recently, apparently, water levels have been gaining a bit. I mean, there's several reasons, like less rain in the past or, you know, climate change impact. It's very difficult to know the exact reason because the region is so dangerous to travel, even for locals. You know, basically, the lake covers borders four countries, Niger, Chad, that's where I traveled, then also Cameroon, Nigeria. And it's a stronghold of jihadists, Boko Haram, Islamic State. And yeah, it's a very remote area, very difficult to reach. And now climate change is really changing the livelihood. It used to feed a lot of people. Now, because of the jihadists, it's less and less possible to do fishing and farming. And yeah, also the weather is changing.
You've touched on a bunch of different topics, which we're going to dive into. Let's first start with that security situation. So you mentioned that it's become a hub for jihadists. That has affected both locals, but it's also made it difficult for researchers to determine just the extent that the lake has gone down. What is the security situation for civilians there? Why are groups like Boko Haram and Islamic State, why are they congregating there?
Boko Haram, Islamic State, they've made Lake Chad their home because it's so difficult to access. It's very remote. It's far away from next large cities, and the states are extremely weak. There is an army presence on each side of the border, the four countries, but they don't really control the lake, especially not the, you know, the interior of the lake. And because of the changing water levels, has turned into basically, you know, a series of channels, small islands. It looks more like small islands and canals than a lake itself, and that it's extremely difficult to control. It's a retreat base for Boko Haram and Islamic State. There are sometimes these four countries, they fly airstrikes against them, but they're unable to control the lake itself. So it's a natural retreat and, you know, base to plot the next attack for jihadists.
Well, you've painted a picture of the lake as being so small that it's really not a big lake anymore. Do people sustain themselves off it, even if it's at a lower scale than what it was 20, 30 years ago?
People still go fishing or harvest on the shores, but say they get less fish and also, you know, get less out of their land. So part of it, the weather changes are dramatic. Sometimes there's a drought. It's one of the hottest areas in the world and temperatures are rising. So farmlands is going to retreat. At the same time, you have really torrential rain flows, so that makes it extremely difficult to plan anything, when to harvest, when to plant crops, when to go fishing. You never know where the thunderstorm is coming. So these changing weather patterns as a result of climate change makes it very difficult for people to keep depending or making a life out of the sea and the surroundings.
And so if it's unpredictable for farmers to plant, given the fact that they don't know if it's going to be too dry or in some cases too wet, what do people do to sustain themselves in that region?
They try to make a living, and then unfortunately many also tempted to join jihadist groups, Boko Haram, Islamic State. They're often being forced because these groups control much of the lake. They tell people, if you want to go fishing or harvesting here, you have to cooperate with us. So people don't really have choices. They're forced to make a choice, and unfortunately quite a few young unemployed people, then they end up with Boko Haram or Islamic State. So that's a real tragedy. The state hasn't much to offer for these people. They don't want to join jihadist terrorists, but they are kind of forced to do for lack of alternatives.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like the old mafia neighborhoods, that if you wanted to operate a business in that neighborhood, you had to pay a bribe to the mafia so that they wouldn't attack you. And it feels in some ways that people here have to maybe not pay, but cooperate with the jihadists in order just to survive and just to continue their daily lives. Is that really the way it is?
Absolutely. So if someone wants to go fishing in the interior of the lake, they, you know, have to give a cut to Boko Haram, like a neighborhood mafia. Now you have to share your catch with them. Same goes for farmers who operate in areas controlled by jihadists. So people don't want this, but since the state is too weak to protect them, and there's often also abuses from armies killing civilians, people then, you know, swallow the bite and work with jihadist groups.
I mean, give us a context of how much of the lake. I mean, again, this used to be the sixth largest lake in the world. It borders four countries. Do the jihadists control the entire periphery of the lake, or is it certain areas, maybe the side that faces Nigeria and Boko Haram? For example, the Islamic militants are more prominent and other parts are more free and open. Or is it the whole lake area is really under their control?
No, I mean, the insurgency started on the Nigerian side in Borno State. And that's where they are on their shores. On the Nigerian side, the jihadists are very strong. Also, you know, and that's maybe the main part, they control the interior of the lake. That's a real red zone. You know, there are lots of small islands, like Fisher Islands, who are not controlled. They're bases from Boko Haram, Islamic State. And there are sometimes airstrikes by the four countries, but they never can undertake a ground operation and really control these islands in the interior of the lake, which make up the stronghold of the jihadists.
Now, is it because of weak state capacity among these four countries that they can't take action against the Islamic militants and the jihadists, or is it because it's not in their core interest to do so? It seems to be some kind of no man's land in that area. Nigeria's already got its hands full dealing with Boko Haram in its mainland national territory. So maybe it just says, listen, we can't fight them everywhere. We're just going to let it go in a place like Lake Chad. Or is it they would like to do something about it, but they simply don't have the ability to do anything?
The four countries simply don't have the ability. As you said, Nigeria has a lot of on its plate with kidnappings going up, crime rates, and Borno State, where the jihadists are. Borno State is bordering Lake Chad. I'm sure they would if they could, because if they got rid of Boko Haram and Islamic State in the Lake Chad area, then that would also improve security in Nigeria. But it's just the state is too weak. The, you know, terrain is too remote. There are no roads. It's difficult for armies to operate. And this natural lake, you know, partly looks a bit like a swamp. It's just the ideal terrain for insurgents to hide, you know, and stage attacks and then retreat quickly.
Now, this would seem that if it's incapable for individual states to be able to do something, that it would be the ideal type of issue to be brought up at the African Union, a more multinational, or even ECOWAS in West Africa, the multinational body for West Africa. Do any of these regional or continental bodies, as far as you know, have any plan to do anything about this or to deploy resources to try and mitigate the impact of jihadists?
Yeah, I mean, they talk a lot, like ECOWAS, African Union, of doing something. At the end, they lack the means, and there has been a bit of support from Western countries, US, UK, France, giving tactical advice to this the four armies, and the four armies form like a multitask, you know, multinational group fighting the GS together. Right now, it's a bit uncertain the future because Chad has asked France to leave. France was the main backer of Chad, has a huge military presence, and also the four countries are a bit at odds. Niger had a military coup; they retreated from that multinational force. So, yeah, unfortunately, there will be less coordination among the four states bordering the lake and even less international support, which is then good news for the jihadists.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up the multinational joint task force. So that used to, and again, I'm using it in the past tense, be comprised of contributions from the United States, from France, and the United Kingdom. You mentioned France, that, again, the complicated history that the French have in this region. And they have more or less been expelled. And as far as I understand, they're not participating in this joint task force anymore. The United States, again, is in a space now where we're not really sure if Donald Trump is going to be that invested in Africa. All indications point to the fact that he's really not keen on committing resources to Africa. Let's not forget that in his first term, he wanted to kill AFRICOM, which is the U.S. military command for the continent. And so hard to imagine he's going to commit a lot of resources to a place that is as far removed as Chad and Lake Chad is from his America First agenda. And then there's the United Kingdom. Is there any hope now, given the politics in Europe and the United States, for continued involvement to a meaningful level by the multinational joint task force?
I pretty much doubt it. Like you said, the French are gone, and with Trump administration, they have bigger fishes to fry, and who cares about this lake in Central Africa? It doesn't affect the United States. I mean, maybe it affects Europe if some more refugees are coming, but in the United Kingdom's own, I'm not sure. I mean, the support force, people talked about 10 to 20, you know, soldiers, you know, were giving tactical advice. It was available, but I just don't see it continue in the current global environment. Also, Chad said they want to do things on their own. Yeah, let's see. But bottom line is that security will worsen that Lake Chad's sea area.
Yeah, and when you were there, what did residents say? What did the civilian population say? Did they want foreigners to be helping there, or did they want more security from the national governments? What were you hearing from people on the ground during your reporting assignment?
They want more security and more, you know, efforts from their armies, but they also, and this is, I mean, it's a bit of a hot topic, there's a lot of, you know, reported abuses that soldiers force, stigmatize locals, claiming you work with Boko Haram, you work with Islamic State. I mean, yes, that may be true, but people don't really have a choice. I mean, they're forced like a mafia neighborhood gang to cooperate with this jihadist, and unfortunately, and that's a problem in the Sahel region in general, and when people are stigmatized by their armies, being labeled as terrorists, whereas in reality just civilians who try to make a living.
And I seem to recall that there were also problems of abuse among the foreign forces that were there as well. So they didn't necessarily build a rapport with the local people. And did that contribute to maybe some of the resistance that may have been found on the ground by the multinational joint task force?
No, I think the abuses were only from the national armies, not from...
Oh, so it wasn't from the foreign forces?
No.
Okay.
This was more like tactical advice, you know, sharing satellite images where can you find Boko Haram, the bad guys. That was the type of Western support. They weren't really on the ground fighting, just behind the scenes helping a bit.
Now, if we look back, I mean, again, you laid out a rather dire situation in terms of the environmental impact that drought and flooding is having, that the shrinking size of the lake and how that's feeding then into the Islamic militarism that's kind of rising up around the lake. What do you think needs to be done, and what are local people and other stakeholders suggesting that should be done? Is this a mass intervention from the outside world? Is there more money being provided to the African Union and to national governments? If there was to be not a solution, but some type of remedy for the difficulties that local people are facing in this region, what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, the major challenge is now that with the Trump administration, they terminated aid, ended the U.S. aid program. U.S. aid was very active in the Sahel, especially in the area of humanitarian aid. So I'd hope that the Europeans are willing to shoulder a bit more and try to, it's not possible to replace all U.S. funds, but a little bit to ease human suffering. But because at the end, I mean, there's already a lot of migrants, refugees coming. not necessarily going to Europe, but going to neighboring countries, which then has an impact on Europe. So hopefully there will be a bit more engagement also from Europe that we don't forget about this crisis. Right now, there's too many crises going on in the world, and everybody is kind of trying to figure out what Trump is doing. But I hope that at least, you know, the Lake Chad area and the crisis doesn't get completely forgotten, because it's a humanitarian crisis there. And sooner than later, people in Europe feel the impact in form of more refugees.
I'm glad you brought that up, because, again, the key question is, why should somebody, say, in Berlin or in Germany or in other parts of Europe, think that this is important? And given the fact that one of the most pressing issues in European politics today is migration issues and making sure that flows of people don't come, it seems like the situation in Lake Chad is exactly a precursor, a hint of what might happen if, you know, these problems go unchecked elsewhere on the continent and in other parts of the developing world, that more people are going to, at some point, if there's no food and no security, they're going to go to where they think they can find refuge. And that is going to be, in many cases, Europe. And so does Europe see, based on what you're seeing, the need to do something about this in a particular place like Lake Chad, given the self-interest that they want to control migration?
Europe is kind of conscious that there's an issue in Africa, but I don't think Lake Chad is on the radar, or Chad itself. In Chad has already 1 million refugees from Sudan, a neighbor to the east, where civil war has been raging. And some of them might move to direction, you know, to Niger and the neighboring country, and then try to go up to Libya and to Europe. And we definitely have to bring Lake Chad on the radar. Because as a result of this humanitarian catastrophe in eastern Chad with the Sudanese refugees, lots of aid money efforts have been redirected there away from the Lake Chad area. And then we're going to feel it at some point. Because like you said, if people are hungry, have nothing to do, and there's no state to offer them any alternatives, at some point they're trying to move on. Maybe not necessarily to Europe, but then to other African countries such as Cameroon, Nigeria, which are also important for Europe. And then they increase social tensions there, job competition. And then the second effect, then more and more refugees or more people will try to migrate to Europe because they don't have a living to make anymore.
Yeah, well, let's look forward now, maybe a year or two or 10 years, however you want to look at the future here. One of the other issues you brought up in your report is the fact that there is a lot of population growth in this area as well, which is going to put additional pressures on the limited resources that are available there. So taking into account climate change, the demographic growth that's there, as well as the Islamic jihadism that you talked about, what's the forecast for the Lake Chad area in the next, say, you know, 2, 4, even 5 years?
I'm very pessimistic. Sahel has one of the highest population growth rates on a global scale in Niger, which also borders Lake Chad. Like, women have 7 children on average, and it's not much less than Chad. There is no state to serve all these people in terms of school, health services, and job competition will increase. And now you have the decision from the U.S. administration to end humanitarian aid, and the Europeans also facing shrinking development budgets. So that is it's a toxic cocktail, you know, and people may not hear much about Lake Chad or care much about, but at some point people will notice it if Chad and other countries get, you know, more destabilized because there's little opportunity for young people to do anything, and they're very, very pessimistic about what might happen.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and it's the intersection of so many different issues, from security to the environment to Africa to population growth. And Ulf, want to thank you so much for your time today. The article is Why Lake Chad Offers Ideal Conditions for Islamist Terrorists, written by Ulf Lessing, who is the head of regional programs in the Sahel for the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, and it's in the latest edition of International Reports. We'll put a link to the article in the show notes of this podcast. And we want to thank you, Ulf, for your time today, and also all of our listeners and our viewers on YouTube for joining us. We'll be back again next month with another edition of International Reports. Until then, I'm Eric Olander. Bye for now.